The American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders is used by clinicians and researchers to diagnose and classify mental disorders. This past May, an updated and revised edition, the DSM-5, was published after more than 10 years of work by hundreds of international experts in all aspects of the field, and it's caused quite a stir. So we thought that we'd find out more about this publication for this week's Please Explain. Joining us is Dr. Michael First, a professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University and a research psychiatrist at the Biometrics Department at the New York State Psychiatric Institute. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Well, my pleasure.
We're also inviting our listeners to join the conversation. If you have a question, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org, also on our Facebook page or on Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. So, Dr. First, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which I will refer to from now on as the DSM, is sometimes referred to as the Mental Health Bible. Can you describe it? What information does it include?
Yeah, Bible's a funny term. I think a better way to think of it is a guidebook. It basically contains all of the mental disorders that are currently accepted as legitimate by the mental health community. So it's a listing of disorders, but what makes it more interesting and more important is it actually gives their definitions, and the definitions are very specific. They use these criteria. So they might say, for example, that major depressive disorder is defined by being depressed most of the day, nearly every day, for at least 2 weeks, plus you have to have a minimum number of other symptoms. So it looks very sort of like a checklist, but it's basically in when mental health professionals make a diagnosis, since we at this point in time don't have laboratory tests or other kinds of objective findings to make our diagnoses, we rely on what people tell us and how they describe their symptoms. And when we do, after we do a very careful history, we apply what we've heard to this definitions in the book. And then when you do that, you end up with someone's diagnosis. And once you've made that decision, that's the first step towards being able to decide what the best treatment is.
Is it the standard mental health manual? Are there others?
No, this is the only one. The DSM has been around in its current form since 1952. This is the DSM-5, the fifth edition. The first edition, which of course is just called the DSM because they weren't editioning it yet, was in 1952, and then in 68 was the second one. In 1980 was the third one. In 1994 was the fourth one. Now we're up to the fifth one. And actually, the gap between DSMs, this is the longest one there's ever been between two DSMs. So I think that's one of the reasons why it's been so anticipated, because the field has been a lot of research in the past 20 years, and I think a lot of people wanted to see how that research would play itself out and the definitions of the disorders.
Who's involved in putting it together?
It's a product of the American Psychiatric Association, which is the professional organization representing the psychiatrists in the United States. But because it has such an impact on all mental health professionals and mental health professionals who are not psychiatrists, like psychologists, social workers, counselors, and others use it as also rely on this as the common language for diagnosis, the American Psychiatric Association, when they put it together, make sure that there are a lot of psychologists and other non-psychiatrists who are involved in the process. And also, because it has some international reach, they've included people from outside the United States. So even though it looks like, you know, it's just a little manual done by a professional organization, it has a much wider reach. And because of that, they've included many more participants beyond psychiatrists.
Since mental health can be quite varied, is it helpful to have standardized language for symptoms and diagnoses? Can't a person have three symptoms but not an important fourth?
Yes, the way to understand why the DSM has been so helpful is to kind of look at what life was like before the DSM-3, which was the third edition in 1980. That was the first edition that actually had these diagnostic criteria. Before that, when a psychiatrist may have said this person had schizophrenia, that it was defined very often based upon their own idea of what the illness was. So it could create a lot of confusion. If you refer someone to a colleague or into the hospital and say, this person has schizophrenia, back in the 50s or 60s, who knows what it would be? I mean, schizophrenia at that point was accepted as, you know, people really not doing very well and they had something seriously wrong with them. But beyond that, there was no agreement about what the thing looked like. DSM-3, which came out in 1980, its big breakthrough was the use of the criteria, and that allowed psychiatrists who see the same patient to agree on what it looks like and what name to give it. So it was hugely helpful with respect to communication. And effective communication, again, is really the first step towards everything else. So that's one of its main virtues, and it remains one of the main advantages of the DSM. And if we didn't have a manual like the DSM, I think most people agree that it would be returning back to a chaos from the 50s or 60s that nobody wants to go back to.
Does it also include suggested treatments?
No, that's the one thing it doesn't do. It's not a treatment manual. It's specifically only covering diagnosis. Now, the treatments that have been developed in the past 30 years during the life of the DSM are geared to diagnoses in the manual. So if you go on the internet and you want to find out what's the best treatment for me, the best way to find that out would be to enter the name of the diagnosis that you've been assigned, and that's because all of the research that's been done does studies geared to that disorder. So major depressive disorder, if your presentation meets the criteria for major depressive disorder, then any study that used the same definition, those results potentially apply to you. So there's a connection between the diagnosis and treatment, but the manual is actually very careful not to include anything about treatment at all.
Has the list of disorders grown since the first manual?
Over years, it's grown, and it's grown for a couple of different reasons. Over time, you know, certain areas which really were not considered the purview of mental health professionals, like sleep disorders and sexual disorders, weren't included in early editions of the DSM. You know, the DSM has always existed as a manual for what people come into clinicians' offices. The idea was always that if somebody walks into your office, you should be able to find them somewhere in the manual. And if not, there's a residual category for people who fall through the cracks. But theoretically, every patient needs to have some diagnosis assigned to them, both for data collection and for reimbursement. So the book is trying to cover everything. So the change in the increase of the number of diagnoses in the DSM partly reflects how the field has enlarged to include areas like sleep and sexual dysfunctions, which were not as prominent back in the 50s and 60s. The other reason why the number of diagnoses increases is we have this phenomenon called splitting. I'll give you an example. People often say when you look at the history of classification, they go back to the 1840 census. And that census was relevant because they actually asked the people doing the census to try to include, you know, people who were mentally ill and indicate that they had a mental illness. They only had two categories then. They had mental retardation and everything else in one, you know, two big baskets. Now, obviously, having a bucket called everything else is not going to be very helpful either for communication or for selecting treatment. So over time, as we know more about the disorders, we give them names and we break this big bucket into smaller and smaller pieces. So what's happened over time, this is true in general medicine as well, that as we know more about the disorders, there's this idea of let's take an existing disorder, split it into two more specific disorders, and usually you do the split because you think that the treatment will be different. So the DSM, as we've learned more about what treatments are effective and what features seem to be important, we keep breaking the disorders up into finer and finer pieces so that they reflect these kinds of this kind of knowledge, which hopefully will lead to better treatment.
But haven't there also been complaints that there's an over-pathologizing of mental health issues in general in this country? Do you see that as a problem?
I think there's a general issue about people liking to, you know, there's lots of pressures for why that might be true. Certainly having a label provides some excuse for maybe not taking responsibility. So I think a lot of people like the idea of having labels. It also allows people to get treatment. So because mental disorders are in fact the boundary between a normal symptom and a mental disorder is actually very fuzzy. Our mental disorders are made up of symptoms that occur in normal people all the time. Insomnia, sadness, anxiety. These terms occur mostly in everyone, and most of whom don't have a mental disorder. Yet the building blocks of the disorders in the DSM use the same kinds of symptoms that occur in normal people. So it creates a dilemma of where do you draw the line? How much depression do you have to go from just normal everyday sadness to clinical depression? You know, how much overeating do you have to go from just an occasional binge to binge eating disorder? These are very tough questions, but because having a disorder or not allows you to make a decision, you have to come up with some kind of cut point. And this is true in medicine as well, like high blood pressure. You know, everybody can go to the drugstore and get their blood pressure taken. At what point do we go from a normal blood pressure to what we now call hypertension? And that threshold has changed over time as we know more and more about, you know, risk factors for heart disease. So the same issue is true in psychiatry, which is made up of symptoms which occur in a continuum. So where you draw that line, and if that line is drawn so low that it might be capturing people who really don't have anything wrong with them, that is a very valid concern. So much of the criticism about the DSM revolves around the concern that somehow the definitions are written maybe too loosely and might be capturing people who don't really have a mental illness and then may get inappropriately given a label.
It's not always clear whether there's a real increase in certain conditions or if they've been diagnosed more than they once were, like ADHD, autism, bipolar conditions.
Exactly.
There are all sorts of other things like that. So do we know whether ADHD, there's an epidemic of autism, or whether it's just simply that we are doing different kinds of diagnoses of them?
That is a very tough question. I mean, autism is an excellent example because the rates of autism from 1980, when it was actually first introduced to the DSM, to now, where it's considered to be 1 in 80, you know, that is a tremendous increase. And there's no question that just having a diagnosis that everybody is aware of has a lot to do with it. You know, that's one of the things about, but one of the purposes of having a diagnostic label is to increase recognition. So as the concept of autism, which started as something very obscure, to something which has become popularized both in the media and in self-help books, there's a simple greater recognition that this kid who seems to be disconnected from his peers, that's not just some, you know, normal weird thing. This actually has a label, and then maybe this label applies, and then maybe the kinds of treatments that we have for autism might be helpful. So,
although in this DSM, there have been changes. Asperger syndrome is no longer considered part of the autism spectrum in the DSM-5, even though it has an awful lot in common with other forms of autism.
What's actually been folded into the autism spectrum? Asperger's was actually first introduced back into DSM in 1994, the last edition. It was a new category. And even from the very beginning, a lot of people wondered whether this was just simply a high-functioning form of autism. But the data at that time suggested, and some of the work that was done in Europe made it seem like maybe these kids had a distinct, something that was related to autism, but was a distinct condition. And I think what has happened from 1994 up to now is the research much more strongly supports the idea that there is a single disorder on a continuum, and the mild cases, which used to be known as Asperger's, are really part of this larger condition. So this is basically a mild autism spectrum disorder, which is what the thing is now called, is probably pretty much equivalent to what was Asperger's. So what's been lost is the label of Asperger's and the notion that these people are somehow fundamentally different than other individuals who are in the autistic spectrum. But in fact, it's really reflecting, I think, the reality that it's all on a continuum, and these are just the mild, more high-functioning cases.
My guest is Dr. Michael First, professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University and research psychiatrist at the Biometrics Department at the New York State Psychiatric Institute. We are talking about the DSM-5, the latest edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And we invite your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org, also on Facebook or on Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Dr. Michael First. We are talking about the DSM-5, the latest edition of the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org. Dr. First, you were involved in putting together the DSM-4. What was your role in that one?
I was the editor of the text and criteria for DSM-4.
How much disagreement is there among the many hundreds of professionals involved with revising and updating each DSM?
Well, there's always disagreement. Like, during the process of the DSM, like with anything, people have, most of the people working on the DSM are researchers and academics, usually very opinionated, and they've there's often many different ways to read the science. So as the process is going on, there's very healthy debate. And then when it nears the end, the debate moves to some form of consensus about what the science shows, and that's what ends up in the final diagnostic criteria sets that appear in the DSM.
Well, for many years, there was disagreement over whether to consider homosexuality a treatable mental disorder. How is it viewed now compared to the earlier manuals?
Yes, the issue about homosexuality is interesting, and it's also somewhat... The removal of homosexuality from the DSM happened in 1972. So homosexuality was in the first DSM, which was in 52. It was in the second DSM in 1968, and it was a few years after the second DSM came out that there was a lot of question about whether or not its being in the DSM was both a valid idea that this was actually a mental illness, and also what was this doing to the gay community at the time, the stigma of being in the DSM. So the in between the DSMs, which is an unusual thing to actually make a change in between major revisions, there was a major rethinking of the idea of homosexuality, mainly because of the concern that this was actually harming people rather than helping them. So they had a kind of a special process, a mid-DSM process, to reconsider this. And what it also ended up doing, which is something that when we look back on this now, we being the people who've worked on the current DSMs, they actually had a vote of the entire membership of the American Psychiatric Association about this. Now, we're kind of horrified by that because the more recent DSMs are predicated on the idea that these are based on science. And science can't, the idea that you could just vote on whether something goes in and out of the DSM is a clear indication that the decision that homosexuality was in the DSM in the first place and then taken out was more of an issue of values rather than just science. So I think the homosexuality story is a very interesting one sociologically, but it you can't really draw much conclusions from that incident to what's happened since then.
Well, on the scientific side, some critics think that the pharmaceutical industry has been overly influential in this current revision. What do you think?
There's always that concern. I mean, this partly reflects a historical concern in the past 10 or 15 years about undue influence of the pharmaceutical industry, which is profit-motivated, and whether they might influence doctors' practices and other types of things to make more money from them. So I think that the question of whether the pharmaceutical industry could have an influence is certainly a valid question, because when a new diagnosis is actually added to the DSM, that does create a potential new market and potential new profits. So I think the raising these issues is very, very important. For this go-round, I mean, I was involved more directly in the DSM-4, and that was in the early 90s. The idea of pharmaceutical influence wasn't as well recognized as it is now. But even while we were working on it, we were cognizant of the idea that we wanted the decisions to be made that reflect the science, and to keep in mind, is this going to affect the pharmaceutical industry? And if so, is there any possibility that they could be exerting any kind of undue influence? You know, from my own personal experience with the DSM-4, I can say from everything I've experienced that there was no overt influence by the pharmaceutical industry on the DSM-4. Moving from DSM-4 to DSM-5, we live in a very different climate. So just the appearance of conflict of interest is as important nowadays as almost the actual conflict of interest. So to safeguard against that, when the DSM-5 process started, they had a very elaborate vetting system where people who were appointed to be on the DSM before they could be approved had to basically submit like 3 years of statements showing where their income comes from. And if, in fact, they received more than $10,000 per year from all the pharmaceutical companies combined, they were not allowed to be on the DSM unless they divested themselves. Plus, there was some cutoff for stock ownership and other types of things. So they wanted to, even though there was never really been any direct evidence of a pharmaceutical company influence, just the risk of that was something that the APA took very, very seriously. So they've instituted this, you know, system that slowed the process down because, you know, there are 150 active participants in the DSM, and each one of them had to go through this fairly elaborate process. So I personally believe that it's been extremely successful, and I don't believe there's any evidence whatsoever of any kind of pharmaceutical company influence on any of the decisions in the DSM-5.
Well, another problem is the DSM-5 has been criticized by the National Institutes of Health, which said it won't fund research projects that rely exclusively on DSM criteria. The NIH director cited the DSM's lack of objective laboratory measurement for diagnosis. When it comes to mental health conditions, are there many ways to objectively measure disorders with laboratory tests? Psychiatrists can't diagnose schizophrenia or bipolar disorder with a blood test, can they?
No, unfortunately, no. I mean, I think it's been very frustrating for us in the field that we're still, that psychiatry is still in a state, like other areas of medicine, like certain, like headaches as a good example in neurology. They also don't have laboratory tests for headaches. In rheumatology and a few other areas where there really are not definitive laboratory tests. And I think the problem is the brain has been very, very difficult to get into and really to understand. So psychiatry relies almost exclusively on the symptoms that patients report, how the symptoms cluster together, and how they evolve over time. That's clearly something that is a problem. Now, it doesn't mean, some people sometimes come to the conclusion that, A, that means that the mental disorders have no reality. And we've been saying for the last 20 years and 30 years that mental disorders are brain disorders. And you say, well, how can you say that if there are no laboratory tests? But there are objective tests that indicate that when someone has schizophrenia, that schizophrenia and bipolar disorders are illnesses that affect the brain. So the problem is this, just to explain why there aren't any lab tests. There are a lot of neuroimaging findings that are true for schizophrenics as a group. So if you take 200 people with schizophrenia and you scan their brain, and you could take 200 normal people who are matched for age and sex and scan their brains, as a group, the schizophrenic group will have a lot of abnormalities on the brain scans compared to the normals. So that clearly shows that schizophrenia as a concept has some validity. The problem is that, you know, that's well and good to say that, but the real issue is when Mr. Jones walks into my office and I need to make a diagnosis of schizophrenia versus bipolar or some other disorder, I would love to have send him for a brain scan, get the findings, and have that result tell me something that would be useful. Unfortunately, the problem is that many people with schizophrenia have completely normal brain scans, and some people without schizophrenia have the brain scans that are typical of schizophrenia. So if Mr. Jones had the finding, it doesn't prove he has schizophrenia. And if Mr. Jones doesn't have the finding, it doesn't prove that he doesn't. So this is the issue of what we call diagnostic specificity and sensitivity. So our tools are still way too crude to be able to be in a period of time where we can use these tests. We all believe that it's simply a matter of time for the research and the technology to improve to the point that these tools will be available. But at this moment of time in history, we simply don't have these tools.
We have to wait for the DSM-6 for that.
Yes,
Tim from Manhasset, hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. I've been under the care of various mental health professionals and often, many times, have asked, what is my diagnosis? What is the name of it? What is the code of the DSM? And then I've gotten reluctance or no answer. Typically, the answer is, well, why do you need to know that? And I'm wondering why a mental health professional would say that. If I went to an orthopedist and had a broken bone in my hand, they would get down specifically to the 100 bones in my hand and say, you have a broken XYZ bone, whereas in mental health, they don't say, this is the name and the code of your diagnosis.
Doctor?
I think it's an excellent question, and it's an excellent point. I think it partly reflects the fact that clinicians in practice find the codes and the labels useful for communication, but they're really very, very limited. They feel that it doesn't tell anything more than just this superficial label. I'm a little disturbed in hearing their reluctance. I mean, I see patients, and I actually very rarely tell people their diagnosis unless they ask, because I personally feel that I'm always a little worried whether if somebody gets a diagnostic label, they'll feel stigmatized or that it'll end up having a negative impact. But certainly, if somebody asks me, it can be very helpful. It says to me that they find it useful and they want to know, and I would tell them. So I'm a little chagrined to hear that they've given you a hard time and weren't just honest and say, this is your label. It has some limitations, but it also has some value, and they absolutely should have told you.
Thank you so much for calling us, Tim.
When I have been told, I have actually not preemptively, but gone to the DSM and said, oh, my goodness, now I understand what's going on for me, because they did give me that name, and I agree with them. That is me. I wouldn't do it before speaking to them. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your call. We go now to Marcia. Hi, Marcia.
Hi, how are you?
From Norwalk, Connecticut. Marcia, I have to make it quick.
Did you call? You asked that question quick?
Yeah, please.
Okay. I'm a psychologist, so I'm on the front line dealing with patients. I'm not a researcher or an academic. And one of the dilemmas that the people that we face is that many of the children who are diagnosed as Asperger's who present with very significant disruptive behavior and also social deficits might not qualify under DSM-5, and yet the schools base necessary services and accommodations on their diagnosis. And I wondered if the doctor had a comment on that.
Yeah, that's a very good point. That's been one of the major concerns. Most of the concerns about DSM-5 are about overdiagnosis. This is one of the few examples where the concern was underdiagnosis, that somehow the change for autism spectrum might exclude people who would have met the diagnosis for Asperger's in DSM-4. The work group heard this concern loud and clear, and they made a number of adjustments to the autism spectrum disorder criteria set, including adding a note saying that if you had met a criteria for a diagnosis in the DSM-4 in the spectrum, you should continue to be considered to meet it in DSM-5. So, you know, there's absolutely no, there was no attempt to try to narrow it and deprive people of services. So I think that in response, this all got started because about a year or so ago, there was a paper that came out that suggested the possibility that a large percentage of people might lose their diagnosis. But there were some methodological problems with that paper, so it's really not clear. So to kind of try to make sure that wouldn't happen, they did tinker with the criteria set. So we do hope and expect that there won't be any people who lose their diagnosis.
We're pretty much out of time, so I couldn't get to the changes in substance abuse and even an internet gaming disorder that's included in DSM-5. But
that's
suspect
only in the appendix, though.
But I suspect it also reflects the changes in society.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I think that there's no question that there have been, you know, many of the disorders reflect. Like internet gaming is a perfect example. Obviously, that disorder couldn't have existed 15 years ago. Pathological gambling does. It always existed because gambling is around. But things do evolve as the context and our environment changes. So I think the DSM will continue to evolve as the you know, things change in our society.
Doctor, thank you so much for participating in today's Please Explain look at the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders 5. I've been speaking with Dr. Michael First, professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University and research psychiatrist at the biometrics department at the New York State Psychiatric Institute. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, thank you. Same here.